Okay, this is WHRW Binghamton. Welcome to the Vegan Rainbow. And today we are joined by my co-host, Karen Coslow. Karen, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hey, Karen. And today we have a very special guest on our show, author and scholar and professor Gary Francione from Rutgers University. Gary Francione has written several books, including Animals, Property, and the Law, and An Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or Your Dog, and Rain Without Thunder, which is a critique of the animal rights movement. And let's see if Professor Francione is on the line. Gary, are you there?
I am indeed, Bill.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us today on
Thank you for having me.
This day that that many people call Turkey Day. This has got to be a day, the number one day for, maybe not the day that the killing occurs, but the day that the killing is for, out of all the days of the year. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. It's a perverse sort of celebration in many ways. It really sort of points out our moral schizophrenia when it comes to animals in a very pointed way.
And you mentioned that key phrase, that that's probably one of the phrases that's most associated with you and your work, is moral schizophrenia. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I think that when it comes to thinking about non-human animals, we human animals have what I call moral schizophrenia. I mean, think about it for a second. Probably more than half of the people who are listening to your show this evening have companion animals. They have dogs or cats or other animals that they regard as members of their families, that they would never consider eating, and that they recognize are sentient beings, that is, beings who can feel pain and experience pleasure, beings that are cognitively very sophisticated. I mean, who has a dog or cat and really doubts that the dog or cat can think, and can think in quite complicated ways? Yet we treat certain animals as members of our family, and we recognize that they're sentient and cognitively sophisticated, yet we stick forks into other animals that are indistinguishable from the animals, both as a factual matter and as a moral matter, that are indistinguishable from the animals that we regard as members of our family. I mean, we really are schizophrenic when it comes to animals. I mean, the bottom line is there really is no difference between the dog or cat that you regard as a member of your family and the turkey that you ate today. And really no difference at all. And if you encountered that turkey in a situation other than on your plate, you would see that that animal is every bit has a personality, every bit as distinct as that is of your dog or cat. So I mean, in a way, it's really sort of bizarre that we do recognize that animals are very much like us, and that they. That they are the sorts of beings that we can have relationships with, that they are animals, that they are beings that have personalities. Yet, you know, we eat other animals, and it just, it's very bizarre. It's always struck me so well, and it strikes me as odd.
There's a quote that I love by a guy called Professor Charles Magel. He says, ask the experimenters, he's talking about vivisection,
yeah.
He says, ask the experimenters why they experiment on animals, and the answer is, because the animals are like us. Yet ask the experimenter why it's morally okay to experiment on animals. The answer is, because the animals are not like us.
Yeah.
Animal experimentation rests on a logical contradiction.
Absolutely.
Is that another example of what you would call schizophrenia? Moral schizophrenia?
Absolutely. I mean, indeed, you know, if you think about it, we use a lot of animals for psychological experiments. And the only value, I mean, if such experiments have any value whatsoever, and I'm not sure that they do, but if they do, it is only because animals are psychologically like us. And if animals are in fact psychologically like us, then they are like us in the way which most of us consider to be most relevant. So I mean, I think you know, again, we don't think clearly when it comes to animals. It is very clear to me that we don't think clearly. that's without doubt.
Now you mentioned that, you know, animals have complex emotional states.
Yeah.
That's one of a large class of different reasons by which people commonly use as an excuse to deny animals their rights. You know, another might be they don't have language, or they don't have desire or belief or a soul or intelligence, some level of intelligence or moral agency. what would you say are the most compelling reasons, perhaps you've already stated them, but for including animals? Would you say that any of these reasons, let's pick one, moral agency? I've heard that quite a few times, that, well, you know, animals aren't moral agents. They don't know right from wrong. Therefore, you know, it's okay for us to murder them and you know, use their hides and their flesh and, you know.
Well, that, you know, look, the argument, what you're talking about is the various reasons that have been given over history for why it's all right for us to exploit animals, these supposed differences that distinguish humans from non-humans. And I have two responses to that sort of argument, and I discuss this quite a bit at length in Introduction to Animal Rights. The first response I have is, first of all, empirically, a lot of these statements are simply not true. As a matter of fact, animals do have many of the characteristics that humans have. And indeed, that's the basic lesson of evolution, isn't it? I mean, isn't that what Charles Darwin taught us? That the difference between humans and non-humans is a difference, is a quantitative difference and not a qualitative difference. That is, there may be differences in degree with respect to certain characteristics, but it is very clear that animals other than humans basically possess all of the characteristics that humans have. And so whatever characteristic you're talking about, whether it's the ability to communicate or the ability to think rationally or the ability to have general concepts or indeed the ability to have moral agency, to make moral decisions and things like that. These are all characteristics that some animals other than humans have. And indeed there are some, very interesting examples of situations where non-humans have intervened to help humans who have been in distress. And so the idea that animals, that no animals except humans are capable of acting morally or thinking morally is, in my judgment, empirically wrong. But even if it were the case that animals lacked some characteristic, like the ability to think rationally or moral agency or whatever characteristic it is, there are some humans that lack whatever characteristic we're talking about. And yet we would never think of using, for example, severely retarded human beings may have certain deficiencies, or they have certain deficiencies but yet most of us, I think, would be uncomfortable about using them in biomedical experiments or as forced organ donors or eating them or putting them in circuses or zoos or rodeos. So, you know, the bottom line is, we recognize that animals are similar to us in that, like us and unlike everything else in the universe, humans and non-humans feel pain. And that's really the thing that I think is most important. What ends up happening, however, is we recognize animals feel pain, but then we take the next step and we say, but it's still all right for us to use them and inflict pain on them because they are different. Even though they feel pain, they're different from us. And as I said, the two-pronged response is, first of all, they're not as different as we think that they are. Indeed, there is no characteristic that we have that is not possessed by some of them. And secondly, even if it weren't the case that they possess these characteristics, so what? Some humans don't possess those characteristics, yet we would never think of exploiting them in the ways that we exploit animals. I would also say this. You know, something very curious about the whole line of argument or the whole procedure of arguing that certain characteristics make us superior. I mean, these are invariably, you might not be surprised to find out, are characteristics that we have. I mean, if, for example, I live with several rescued canines. One of my canines is a border collie who can jump about 5 feet in the air from a sitting position. Now, I can't do that. So there may be certain things that I can do that she can't, but there are certain things that she can do that I can't. I mean, she has a sense of smell that is qualitatively different from mine. Fish can breathe underwater without any sort of assistance. I can't do that. You can't do that. There's no human that can do that. So, I mean, there are, it becomes almost a sort of a puzzling way to argue. Say, well, we have certain characteristics that are superior, so therefore we're superior. So, I mean, I think this whole line of reasoning really falls apart. Again, if we think about it logically and we think about it rationally, which is this characteristic that we think that we possess that no other animals have, if we do think about it rationally, we recognize that these differences or the arguments based on these differences really are invalid.
Yeah, I think that some people would even argue that maybe our president doesn't possess moral agency.
Well, certainly if intelligence is a criteria, a number of people in government who are in big trouble, actually. But, yeah.
Karen and I were talking before the show, and she had an observation about, we're talking about this consistency factor. Sometimes it's really hard to be consistent, once you have the particular belief that, animals, shouldn't be, treated, with disregard of their own feelings.
Yeah. When I had a dog, I fed her vegetarian dog food, and she lived to be 15 years old, and she was perfectly healthy.
Yeah.
However, now I have 3 cats, and I feel like I'm, enduring this moral schizophrenia on a personal level, because I'm feeding them, canned cat food, and I'm just wondering, how do you feel about that?
Well, are you a vegan?
99.9%.
Well, my view is that if you're doing everything you can, and you basically are not exploiting animals in terms of your own life. I think that the cat situation is a difficult situation. I mean, cats. I don't live with any cats, but my friends who do have cats tell me that they have tried all sorts of things to get them to accept vegan diets, and it's just a no go when it comes. Now, I live with dogs, rescued dogs, and they are all vegans, and they're quite happy vegans, and they're very healthy vegans. And I have a number of ancient dogs that I was told would never survive, and they're pretty old. But I think with cats, I don't have any personal experience with this, but my friends who have cats tell me that it's virtually impossible. And I don't know. I think it's a difficult situation. I wish that we were all vegans, and the only problem in the world we had to worry about is what we were going to do with cats. The problem I have is I encounter a lot of animal rights advocates, or so-called animal rights advocates, who aren't vegans, and then they tell me that they're worried about what to do with their cats. And I always tell them, worry about you. You can make decisions. Cats can't. You make once you've made all the moral decisions you can make, and once you've tightened it up in terms of your own life, then, start worrying about cats. Now, I do have to tell you, I did receive an email recently from someone who told me that he and a friend had discovered a vegan alternative that cats loved. So I'm waiting to see this go out in the market, and I hope that it will be sooner rather than later, because I think there are a lot of folks out there who would be a lot happier feeding their cats a vegan diet, not only for moral reasons, but because they're concerned, rightly so, that commercial cat foods have companion animals sort of ground up and included as an ingredient,
yeah.
And
that's
not only a disgusting recipe, but a recipe for all sorts of health problems,
like prion related diseases.
Yes, exactly.
I noticed something very that some people might consider to be unusual. You said I live with dogs. You didn't say I own dogs.
No, I don't regard it that way. And let me tell you something. Neither do they. No, I don't. I mean, look, I don't believe that we should own animals. I don't believe that we should, let me take a step back. There's a lot of confusion about what animal rights means. I mean, people always ask me, do animals have the rights to, go to school? Or, they get confused about what animal rights means. And they think that, when we talk about animal rights, we think that animals should have all the same rights that humans have. And I think there are some people who may take that position. I don't. I believe that animals should have one right, and that is the right not to be property. Indeed, if you deny them the right to be property, then they will have no moral significance, no matter what you say. You will treat them as chattel, as things, without any moral significance whatsoever, which is exactly what our society does. On one hand, again, this goes back to the moral schizophrenia. On one hand, we say that, we take animal interests seriously. On the other hand, we disregard animal interests whenever we believe that it provides a benefit for us, even trivial benefits of entertainment or whatever, to do so. So, again, it goes back to this schizophrenia. And I think that the reason why we regard animals in the schizophrenic way is because because animals are our property. And as a result, when we think about conflicts between humans and animals, we think about conflicts between property owners and their property. And it doesn't take a great deal of legal knowledge or anything else for that. Or it takes no more than common sense to realize that in a conflict between property owner and property, property owner is going to win. We had all sorts of laws that supposedly protected human slaves in the 19th century, and human slaves received virtually no protection because the courts were not able to deal with conflicts between slave owners and slaves, because those were conflicts between property and property owners. And property doesn't make much sense as an institution if the property is going to win. So, you know, as a bottom line, I maintain that animals ought to have one right. And that's the only right. I have a theory of animal right in the singular, as it were. That is, animals ought to have one right, the right not to be property. The problem is, if you recognize that one right, then the world changes dramatically, because it's no longer a question of making exploitation more humane. It's a question of abolishing exploitation altogether, just as, by the way, occurred in slavery. We recognize that the issue was not making slavery more humane. There were people who argued that we ought to make slavery more humane, but ultimately the view that prevailed, and I happen to think it was the right view, was the view that slavery as an institution ought to be abolished, because the problem was not how do you tidy up the institution of human property. The problem is, was the institution of human property morally justifiable? We came to the conclusion, no, it was not. I do not believe there are any arguments in favor of maintaining the institutions of animal property either. So yeah, no, I don't regard the canines with whom I share my home as my property. The law does, but I don't, and I regard them, I guess, best way I would say, I sort of regard them as refugees. You know, beings that are in a world that they in which they really don't belong, and they're vulnerable. We've made them vulnerable. I regard us as having an obligation to take care of them, but I also think we should not continue to breed them. I mean, if there were two dogs left in the world, and it were up to me whether they bred so that humans could continue to own dogs, the answer would be no, absolutely not. I think we should take care of the ones that are here, but I don't think that we should continue to bring them into existence. And that's the same thing I think about all other domestic animals. That if we, you know, that if we accepted that animals have the right not to be property, the solution would not be, you know, you open all the cages or, you know, you let them all run around the streets. I'm not maintaining that. What I'm saying is, if we took their moral interests seriously and we stopped regarding them as our property, the solution would be to stop producing them. You know, we manufacture conflicts between humans and animals by bringing domestic animals into existence, and then we sit around saying, well, what are our obligations to these animals? And the answer is, once we're bringing them, you know, if you're bringing millions of animals into existence for the sole purpose of killing them, the idea that, you know, you sit around thinking about what are our moral obligations is rather bizarre from my point of view.
We are speaking with Professor Gary Francione, author and scholar, professor of law at the Nicholas Katzenbach School of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University. Author of several books, including Animals, Property, and the Law, and Rain Without Thunder. Let me ask you one question.
Bill, let me just correct you one second. I'm at the it's not the Nicholas Katzenbach School of Law. It's I'm the
Scholar of Law. I'm sorry.
Scholar of Law. Yeah, it's a title. They academics love titles, and they give us titles. You see, in lieu of giving us raises, they give us titles. but that's the position that I hold at Rutgers Law School.
I'm sorry about that. Thanks
that's
for
right.
The correction on that.
That's quite right.
Now, one thing I notice in your whole view of things, this is going to be a hard question for you, I think, that maybe the hardest one you'll get during this this hour, unless we get some tough callers. I notice you know, the one right that you want to acknowledge that animals innately have is this right only has meaning in relation to humans, in human interactions. And the thing that, I would think is... I think about the statement of human rights in the second declaration, or the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all, you know, men, maybe persons, are created equal and endowed with certain rights such
well,
as the
rights... Well, but it's important to recognize, when those words were written, it was men, and not even all men, it was white men. So
white property owning men.
You know, white property owning men. So,
right.
So, you know, we shouldn't lose track of the fact that The concept of rights, as that concept has developed historically, both inside the United States and outside the United States, didn't have universal application.
So
and there are some people who don't think still it has universal application. I mean, there are a lot of people, for example, who still have ideas about sexism, for example, or racism, in which they don't really believe that either women or people of color are real full members of the moral community.
That is an interesting point, because it actually can give us all in the animal rights movement hope that this notion of rights is an expanding notion, and maybe it will someday expand to include all sentient creatures.
But remember something also. We have, you know, we apply the concept of rights to humans who don't necessarily have who don't themselves necessarily have the concept of rights. For example, we don't have any problem talking about children's rights, even though children may not understand what rights are, or they might not apply them in their interactions with each other or something, or people who are cognitively impaired or mentally disabled or whatever may not have the concept of rights, but that doesn't mean that we think that it's all right to use them instrumentally, exclusively as means to our ends. So, you know, just because a particular human may not be able to understand the concept of rights, that doesn't mean that we think it's all right to use that person in experiments or as a forced organ donor or, you know, whatever. And, you know, and also let me just say this. I think a lot of our discussion of the treatment of non-humans gets sidetracked by our focus on rights, because as soon as we start talking about rights, the immediate reaction is to say, well, we think about rights in terms of particular rights to do X, Y, Z, P, Q, and R. And we start saying, well, we ask, well, do these activities have any applicability to animals? And if the answer is no, because animals don't really have an interest in voting or attending university or doing many of the things that we talk about in terms of the content of human rights, then that means the concept of rights is really inapplicable to animals, and that's an issue that I deal with in Introduction to Animal Rights, because I try to explain that the right not to be property is a basic fundamental right. If you don't have that right, you're not going to have any moral significance whatsoever. You will be a thing. You will be a thing that has no value except as a means to the ends of others. And so that if we don't want animals to be that way, we don't have a choice. We've got to accord them this one right, which means that certain aspects of our treatment of animals have to be changed rather dramatically. But let me just say this, that our discussion about the moral status of animals really doesn't even, in many respects, depend on rights theory. I think we need to talk about rights theory, and we need to talk about property and the right not to be property. But I also think, let's think about it from a non-rights perspective, for example. Everybody who is listening to this show, whether they believe in animal rights or not, I mean, let's assume that they don't. Everybody who is listening to the show believes in the proposition that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary pain and suffering on animals. Everybody. I mean, it's very difficult to find anybody who would disagree with that. Now, we can have a philosophical discussion about what necessity means, but we don't have to have that, and indeed, in an hour, we're not going to get very far. But the one thing I think that everybody would agree with is that if a rule that we ought not to inflict unnecessary pain and suffering on animals means anything, necessity must mean that pleasure, amusement, or convenience can't suffice as a justification. I mean, if you have a rule that says it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering on humans, for example, but it's okay to do so if we get pleasure, amusement, or convenience out of it, then that would be to create an exception that would swallow up the rule. Now, we apply that, you know, we believe that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary pain and suffering on animals, and surely if that rule means anything, it means that we can't inflict pain and suffering on animals for pleasure, amusement, or convenience, or else the rule doesn't mean anything. But yet, 99.99999% of what we do with animals can be justified only by pleasure, amusement, or convenience. Let's focus on the most numerically significant use of animals, that is the use of animals for food. In this country alone, we're killing approximately 9 to 10 billion animals a year for food. Now that's, you know, a billion is 1,000 million. That's a lot of animals. It's a great many animals. Now, it is almost 2004. Nobody maintains that we need to eat animals to lead an optimally healthy lifestyle. Indeed, an increasing number of mainstream healthcare people are saying that animal products are not good for our health. Every ecologist I know acknowledges, whether they eat meat or not, they acknowledge, as an intellectual matter, that animal agriculture is a disaster for the planet. I mean, for example, it takes between 6 and 12 pounds of plant protein to produce 1 pound of flesh. So every time you're eating, you know, 1 pound steak, you're eating about 11, 12 pounds of plant protein. It takes many times more water to produce a pound of flesh than it does to produce a pound of wheat or potatoes. So it's an environmental disaster. I mean, and there's quite a bit of data out there. As a matter of fact, I'm not aware of anybody who maintains that animal agriculture is sustainable or good for the planet. I mean, most people acknowledge it's a disaster. So even if you put aside the moral issues with respect to our treatment of animals, animal agriculture is not good for our health. It certainly isn't necessary for our health. It's not good for the planet. And the best justification we have for killing 10 billion animals a year is they taste good.
Right.
So really, when you think about it, you know, and I just, you know, for the past 2.5 minutes, I haven't even mentioned the concept of rights. You don't need, in my judgment, you don't need a theory of rights to come to the conclusion that you ought to be a vegan. All you need to do is to take seriously a moral proposition that for the past 200 years we've accepted as uncontroversial, and that is that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary pain and suffering on animals. If we really took that seriously, we wouldn't be eating them.
Right.
So you know, and so I think, and you don't even need to get to rights to arrive at that conclusion. I mean, I think you do need rights theory to understand some of the finer points. But you know, it's really distressing to me. I meet a lot of people who tell me, oh well, you know, I'm an animal rights advocate or whatever, and yet they're not even vegetarians or vegans, and that's true for a lot of people who are prominent in the animal rights community that I've known over the years. I've been doing this now for 22 years.
I also noticed the same thing in the peace movement, that a lot of people are against war and because of their anti-violence, yet they go home and eat a cheeseburger.
Yes, this is a curious thing. Again, it shows how deeply ingrained a lot of these exploitative behaviors are. But you know what? You could say the same thing about a lot of there are a lot of behaviors that we exhibit. I think sexism is an excellent example of another behavior where a lot of people who think of themselves as politically progressive nevertheless don't recognize that a lot of things that a lot of behaviors are sexist. I mean, I deal with this issue in the animal rights movement all the time, because in the animal rights movement has an enormous amount of sexism in it, and a lot of the campaigns are very sexist. I mean, I'd rather go naked than wear fur and all this sort of stuff.
Ah, yeah.
And you try to sort of explain to people, look, as long as we're treating women like pieces of meat, we're going to continue to treat meat like pieces of meat, and maybe we ought to really start rethinking a lot of this. Those sorts of observations oftentimes do not fall on fertile earth, and people get upset when you make those observations. But you know, it's true of the peace movement that a lot of progressives don't see the inconsistencies in terms of eating meat. I see this with people who call themselves environmentalists. I was recently having lunch with a friend of mine who's a fabulous environmental lawyer, one of the finest folks out there, and he was eating meat, and I said, well, don't you see that there's a problem here? And you know, he acknowledged that, you know, yeah, certainly there were issues about meat in terms of the environmental impact, but yet, you know, he thought that his eating a hamburger really didn't contribute all that terribly much. And in one sense, it doesn't. I mean, you know, the individual eating the hamburger is not making a significant contribution to environmental degradation. The problem is, if you multiply that by millions and billions, we are. And that moral change has to start on an individual level. That if we don't start making changes in our individual lives, then ultimately there's not going to be social change. Which is, by the way, one of the things I tell my law students all the time when they say, "Well, I want to be an animal rights lawyer," and I always say to them, "Well, you know, let me explain something to you. Until we get a larger number of people to recognize as a social matter, until we educate people in a more effective way to understand that animal exploitation is not a good idea, and that we ought to, and that more of us start becoming vegans, the idea that the legal system is going to be a significant engine for change is folly. That is not going to be the case. I mean, we're not going to get a court to declare that animals are persons, or you're not going to get the Congress to enact a law that says that animals are persons, or you're not going to get a constitutional convention and a change in the Constitution to say that the 14th Amendment applies to animals as long as 99% of us are eating them. So I think that we need to do a much better job. I think the animal rights movement needs to do a much better job in terms of educating people about veganism. And then and only then will it be possible to get social institutions to change through legal means.
We are talking with Professor Gary Francione, author and scholar and animal rights. Yeah, you run the Animal Rights Center at Rutgers University. Is that correct?
Yeah, what happened was, Bill, that was the outgrowth. What happened was in 1990, I've been doing a lot of litigation concerning animal issues, and in 1990, Anna Charlton and I formed something called the Animal Rights Law Clinic at Rutgers, where what we started doing is litigating cases, but we integrated that activity into the curriculum of Rutgers, and so we had students who were getting academic credit for working with us on litigating animal cases. We did that until about 2000. And now what we do is we teach courses. The clinic that we had, the litigation clinic, is on a hiatus. We decided that we decided to put that on hiatus for a while and to work more on educational projects. And so we teach a class at Rutgers. We work with students on individual research projects and independent studies having to do with animal issues. We go and lecture at other universities, and we have an umbrella term, we call it the Animal Rights Law Project, as the umbrella designation for all of the things that we do.
Let's talk for a bit about, I know you've been doing a lot of recent work lately critiquing the animal rights movement in this country. I think that was the topic of your book, which I haven't read, Rain Without Thunder. And I've also read an interview that you did with Friends of Animals, which covered this topic. What would you say the thesis of your book, Rain Without Thunder, is?
Well, I think that the American animal rights movement has basically collapsed and has sort of become a curious thing. It's actually somewhat complicated because as a historical matter, the animal rights movement evolved from the animal welfare movement, which existed in the 19th and 20th centuries in both Britain and the United States. And the animal welfare movement was the movement that, well, it was all right to use animals, you just had to do it nicely. And the animal rights movement evolved from that idea. The problem is that I think that this is particularly true in the United States, that the animal rights movement in the United States came to recognize that an abolitionist message, promoting veganism, for example, as a primary baseline moral principle, was not popular because people want to continue to eat meat and animal products, and it interferes with getting donations to pursue this vegan line. And I think that also as a practical matter, these organizations, these large national groups are businesses, and they have to continue to bring in the donations, and the way that they bring in donations is by having campaigns, and the way that they they have to have campaigns that are at least now and then successful. So what happened is a confluence, I think, of some of these economic factors. The organization began to embrace the bigger cage theory. Well, yes, we think ultimately that we ought not to be eating them at all. However, in the meantime, let's get them bigger cages. And I think that that sort of thinking metastasized through the movement, and the animal rights movement became the animal welfare movement of the 1940s and 50s in this country. And I think that that's what we have now. We have a movement basically where most of the large organizations are promoting larger cages. They're promoting, recently I was somewhat astounded to see one of the large animal rights groups saying that, well, we should boycott one of the fast food chicken places until they start gassing chickens. Now, this I find very odd because,
right.
what message is that sending out? I mean, we should boycott them until they start gassing chickens. Well, what it suggests is once they agree to start gassing chickens, then it's all right for us to eat them. And even though that's not really the message I think that they think they're promoting, that's the effective message that they're sending to the public. This same organization, and we're talking now about PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, has been doing things like praising McDonald's for adopting supposedly more humane standards and praising some of the other fast food places. And I think the message that sends out to people is that, well, it's all right to patronize these places as long as they do what PETA says they ought to do, and then they get the PETA stamp of approval.
There's a group called Viva USA, which I've just contacted recently because they organized a campaign against Whole Foods regarding the selling of duck meat, which was supposedly raised really inhumanely. And then they decided to call it off all of a sudden because the head of Whole Foods, his name is Mr. Mackey, he came out and said, well, I've actually, based on my conversations with you, I've become a vegan, and I'm going to make sure that the suppliers in a couple of years start having more humane conditions, and they called it all off. Whole Foods is still selling meat. They're still selling duck meat. It just didn't seem like, what they were after was very, very, or what they got was very substantial.
Well, yes and no. It's not substantial. However, it allows you now to send out, millions of pieces of direct mail to people saying, we've got a victory, send us money. And that's really, unfortunately, I think that's a lot of what's going on here, is that people need campaigns. And they need victories, however insignificant the victories are. So they end up promoting these rather peculiar positions. And I think it's really counterproductive. I think it sends out the wrong message. I think what we need to be doing, and what the animal rights movement has done, in my judgment, a rather lousy job of doing, is educating people more about the need for abolition. And I am not unrealistic. I do not believe that we are going to achieve abolition overnight. On the other hand, I do not think that trying to get, larger cages or slightly more humane conditions really are going to do anything in the end. And indeed, as a historical matter, and this is a point that I make in Rain Without Thunder, as a historical matter, when you have these welfarist, quote, improvements, end quote, you generally tend to encourage, not discourage, further exploitation. If you have a humane slaughter act, that makes people, more comfortable, not less comfortable, about eating meat. So what you actually end up doing, this is something when I was studying the development of the historical development of the animal rights movement in this country, I learned that in 19th century England, there were actually very few animals that were used for biomedical research in the 19th century. In 65, 66, so somewhere the later half of the 19th century, Britain passed a law that regulated the use of animals in experiments. And this had the effect of causing the number of animals to skyrocket. And the reason historically that occurred was because people felt more comfortable about the use of animals in biomedical experiments once there was regulation. And I think that the same is true generally of virtually all welfarist changes. They make people feel more comfortable, not less comfortable, about the institutional exploitation of animals. And I think that, what we need to be doing is trying to raise consciousness about the institutional exploitation of animals and not try to address the situation by saying, okay, well, let's give battery hens an inch more of cage space. The answer is that will take years. It will be almost impossible to implement or to monitor. And in the end, really, what have you done? What you've done is make people feel better about eating eggs. I see this now with free range eggs. What are free range eggs? I mean, by and large, as many of us know, perhaps all your listeners are not aware, that the eggs that they produce, that they eat, are produced in what they call egg batteries, where you have four animals, four hens in a cage that goes between 150 and 190 square inches. The animals have basically no space. It's really a horrible, horrible life for them. and they suffer greatly, and a lot of people are aware of that, so they say, well, I want free-range eggs. Well, there's no definition of free-range, and, you know, you can have a larger cage, and you can call it free-range, and there's really nothing legally that can be done, and what and that has the effect, actually, I think, of making people feel better about eating eggs rather than asking themselves, do I really need to eat, is this really necessary for my health to eat eggs? The answer is no, and maybe the thing to do is to stop purchasing them altogether, not purchasing the free-range eggs. I see this also at places like Whole Foods. They now have counters where they are selling meat that is supposedly humanely raised because they're catering to the animal crowd that says, well, you know, I'm not really willing to give up meat, but I want more humanely raised meat, when instead the issue ought to be, why are you eating it in the first place?
Right.
And I think that a lot of these animal organizations are moving the ball in a very wrong direction. And I think that reliance on these welfarist campaigns really isn't really changing things at all. And I think that the proof is in the vegan pudding. Things are really no better now for animals than they were. We're using more animals now in more horrific ways than we ever have in human history. So the bottom line is, as a movement, it's failed. You know, do we have a veggie burger at Burger King? Yes. Is it vegan? No. You know, I mean, so yes, are McDonald's promising us that hens will get a bit more cage space? Yes. Will Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, the $64 million question, will Kentucky Fried Chicken gas their chickens or not? And the answer is, well, you know, who cares? I mean, is that really a significant change? Is that what we really want? After years of work, and the answer is, I think that if we consider those things victories, we need to really redefine what a victory is.
We live in strange times today. We live in times when we have these entities which are legal fictions known as corporations, mm-hmm. which are endowed with rights of personhood.
Sure.
Yet we have living sentient creatures. The phrase I like to use is creatures with eyes and a brain.
Right.
Because that I think that people really think, oh, eyes and a brain, that's something that I have, and that makes them understand that the animals are like them.
Right.
That these sentient creatures, which are, like you said, very much emotionally similar to us, in many ways similar to us, you know, beating hearts, you know, blood coursing through their veins, they're denied this right of personhood. Do you think that a legal definition of animals as living persons would be like a start to maybe a change in the tide?
No, I don't, because I think the law has for 200 years recognized that animals are sentient, that they are different from rocks and chairs and non-sentient entities. We've recognized that animals are much like us. I mean, we may still think that there are important and significant differences, but we all recognize. We have anti-cruelty laws because we recognize that, you know, we don't have animal cruelty laws that apply to stones. They apply to animals, and we recognize that animals are different from plants and rocks and chairs and things like that. So I think that the idea that animals are living sentient creatures is an idea that is already in the law and has been in the law for the better part of a couple hundred years. I mean, there was a cultural revolution that occurred in the 19th century, where before then we really didn't have laws that dealt with animals such as anti-cruelty laws. But the acceptance, the evolution of anti-cruelty laws marked social recognition that animals were in fact sentient beings, and they were different from other sorts of things that existed, and they were like us in that one sense, at least in that one sense, in that they were able to feel pain, and that they had an interest in not feeling pain. So it's not clear to me that we're really going to change things by yet more, you know, legal definitions. I mean, there are campaigns that are trying to get legal definitions of animals as sentient beings. Well, I mean, again, I believe we already have that. There are campaigns that are trying to get us to say that, well, we're guardians of dogs and cats, we're not owners. And the answer is, again, that strikes me as somewhat useless, because even though I don't regard my animals as my property, I treat them as beings that I respect, that share my home with me, the bottom line is that whatever you want to call them, I still have the right to kill them. I can still take my dogs to the vet tomorrow and say, put these animals down, because they are my property. So even if we have these campaigns that say, well, animals are not our property. They are, we're their guardians. They're not our property. The bottom line is, as long as they are legal property, I don't care what you call them. You still have the right to end their existence for no good reason other than the fact that you want to go on vacation and they're an inconvenience to you. So I think, I think that a number of these things, the Guardian campaign, some of these other campaigns trying to get animals defined as sentient beings, again, these are campaigns that they may serve organizational interests. They may allow the groups that promote them to go to their members and say, look at what we're doing. Please give us donations. Do I think that they matter a hill of beans in the grand scheme in terms of how we're treating animals? And the answer is no. I really believe that veganism is the most important issue. As long as we are continuing to eat them, and as long as our best reason for doing that is they taste good, then we're not going to, it doesn't matter what else we do. Everything else is really beside the point, Bill. I really think it's just beside the point.
Let me ask you about, I still think that I'm trying to put my hand on this question here, that, there's a philosophy behind all action, and there's a philosophy that precedes the codification of law. And, we have certain philosophies in our culture which are promoting or allowing for the present sort of treatment that we have toward animals. And I'm wondering if I can throw out a couple of central ideas.
I agree with you, and the extension of that is the law doesn't change until the social philosophy which animates it changes. So you can't look to the law to say, well, let's change the law, and then we'll change the philosophy. It doesn't work that way. You've got to change the philosophy first before the law's going to change. But go ahead.
So what do you think about, I'm going to throw out two, and you can take them individually if you want to, religion and capitalism. How have they, individually or whatever, how do they affect our beliefs that chattel property is permissible and okay in murdering animals?
Well, both of them have had profound effects on our treatment of non-humans. Capitalism is a theory which allows us to commodify humans to some degree, and as capitalism, different forms of capitalism commodify humans in particular ways. And
as in with like the division of labor?
Well, sure. This is a complicated issue, but basically capitalism places a price tag on the interests of humans, and then attempts to alienate interests from humans and cause them to pay actually to have their interests respected. Capitalism is a factor in this, that's for sure. And religion, I think, is and the line between religion and capitalism is actually much, much more blurry than we might think it.
But I agree with that.
Materialism is every bit a sort of a metaphysical commitment to the world as much as any religious view is. But I think that religion has played a significant role, because many religions, not all religions, but many religions, particularly the Judeo-Christian tradition, animals are regarded as inferior, and we are taught that we are made in God's image, and therefore, and that we are superior because we're made in God's image, and that animals are given to us, the most weighty responsibility that we have, if any, is to treat them kindly. What's very, very interesting to me is, last year, I guess, one of Bush's speechwriters, a guy named Matthew Scully, wrote a book called Dominion, and it's an indication of how welfarist the animal movement has become, that this book was promoted and is being promoted by all of the most of the animal rights organizations in this country, and indeed is being promoted by PETA. It's a frightening book, which is about as progressive as St. Thomas Aquinas. So we've actually taken a step back to the 13th century. And what Scully argues in the book is that, well, we are superior. I mean, we are made in God's image, but we have a responsibility to treat them kindly.
Doesn't he set up some kind of hierarchy too? Apes are you know, being closer to us, they deserve, you know, greater consideration.
Absolutely. You know, this is years ago. I did a chapter in a book called The Great Ape Project, and the guy who put that together, a guy named Peter Singer, first asked me to do the chapter, I said no, I wouldn't do it because I didn't want to get into saying that, well, apes are different from other animals. And I ended up writing the chapter, but I try to make the point that although the apes were very much like us and perhaps deserved some of the same rights that we had, the sentience was the only characteristic that, in my judgment, was required for the right not to be property and the right not to be treated exclusively as a means to human ends. The idea we're going back to that idea now. I thought that the Great Ape Project I think that was 1992, whatever. Now that's been resurrected by Steve Wise and some of his work, where he's saying, well, you know, we ought to accord rights based on how closely animals are to us. And so he talks about, well, if the apes have intelligence like ours, then we should bring them into the moral community. And the answer is, well, why does intelligence matter? Why does anything matter other than sentience? Because it seems to me that any argument that says, well, they have to be like us in order to have moral consideration just falls back on this whole notion of human hierarchy, human superiority. And I think those arguments are very elitist. They are very hierarchical, and I think that they go back to ideas that I think we should have rejected a long time ago. So it's very distressing to me to see supposedly animal rights organizations embracing ideas, as I said, that St. Thomas Aquinas wrote about centuries ago, and positions that he took centuries ago that I don't think are particularly progressive, that are being promoted by animal organizations in 2003. It's really quite disconcerting, and I think is an indication of how the movement really is not moving. The movement's going backwards. In many respects.
We are almost out of time. Man, you are one of the easiest interviews I've ever had. We just get you going and just carry it on. I want to go back, and I never really got to ask my hard question. My hard question is, your philosophy seems to be based on the idea that that animals are deserving of certain treatment with respect to humans being not to be treated as property. Why not say that animals have an inherent right to life?
Well, an inherent right to life. I don't know exactly. That's a conclusion. I mean, I do think animals have an interest in life. They have an interest in their lives. In addition to an interest in not suffering, they have an interest in their lives. And I think that that ought to be respected. Because we have no good justification for not respecting it. I think that the burden is on us to justify inflicting suffering or taking their lives. And I don't think that we have a good justification for doing that. But again, part of the peculiarity of this whole area is, if we were to respect the interest that they have in their lives or in not suffering, we wouldn't bring them into existence in the first place anymore. So, you know, the issue to me, as I say in Introduction to Animal Rights, is not whether the cow should have a right to sue the farmer. I'm interested about why we have the cow here in the first place. And that if we really regarded animals as having moral significance, we would stop bringing them into existence. We would stop dragging the dog into the burning house and then say, which one should I save, the child or the dog in the burning house, if I can only save one? There is something bizarre about domestication, bringing these animals, bringing billions of animals into existence for the sole purpose of exploiting them, and then say, you know, then agonizing over what our moral obligations are. I think once we have brought them into existence for the purpose of using them for what are in the overwhelming number of instances, merely trivial uses, we've already decided they don't have any moral significance. So it becomes a very sort of circular and unsatisfying discussion, in my judgment.
Professor Francione, thank you very much for being our guest here today. You are the author of several books, Animals, Property, and the Law, Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or Your Dog, Rain Without Thunder. There's a fourth one.
Yes, Vivisection and Dissection in the Classroom, A Guide for Conscientious Objectors. It has to do with the rights of students not to use animals as part of their academic work.
And do you have a website?
Yes, at www.animal-law.org. And the books are all published by Temple University Press, and people can find them on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble or Borders or whatever. And there's information about the books on the website, and there should be an email address, and I love to hear from people.
Great. Thank you again very much for joining us, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you very much. Thank you both very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been Vegan Rainbow. I'm Bill Houston and
Karen Koslow.
And we'll see you next time.